Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
This week on Meet and Three, we're ringing in the start of our fifth season with dispatches from Portland, Oregon's biggest food festival, Feast Portland. We're bringing you words of wisdom on launching a food business from food blogs.
Most acquaintances from high school have now tried to start a food or fashion blog in some sense and quit very quickly afterwards.
To ice cream shops.
Every city you go to, the salt and straw is completely different than any other city.
We'll bring you insights and anecdotes about the business of the business.
We were like, cool, we're going to do this. We're going to try to raise $75,000 and we'll see what happens. And it was like the most gut-wrenching, miserable month.
Tune in to Meet and Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome to HRN Happy Hour. It's 5 o'clock somewhere, and somewhere is Bushwick. I'm Kat Johnson, the communications director here at HRN, here with Katie Mosman-Wadler and Hannah Forden.
Hey there.
What's up, Kat?
It feels really early for a Thursday.
I just feel like I just woke up.
All
kinds of ways. We also have in studio with us Kevin Chang Barnum. Welcome.
Hello. Hi.
Hi, Kevin. Kevin's one of our new interns.
I wanted to say good morning for some reason.
It's because it is the morning.
That's right.
Surprise.
It's also not Thursday.
It's not 5 o'clock.
Surprise. We're doing a very special episode today with a very special guest.
It is the one and only Rob Newton. Welcome, Rob.
Hey, how are you?
So
the one and only. That's very
one
fancy.
One and
very
only.
Fancy.
I mean, there might be others, but they're imposters. They're not the true.
Don't want to talk about it.
They don't have a book coming out today?
Exactly.
Bingo.
That's why we're here.
Very special, and this is why we're early. Rob, you mentioned before the show, this is your first stop on your book promo tour.
Yeah. It's kind of surreal. It's finally here, and here we are. Thank you for having me.
We first talked about this book with you 2 years ago. When we all started kind of planning this gala, which we'll talk about in a minute, and you were in the weeds with writing this book, and it's here.
I know. And I had been working on it, you know, for a long time, even prior to that, and it just seems surreal is the best word I can come up with, because it's sort of like opening a restaurant, too. You know, you finally put this thing out there, and you don't know how people are going to react to it, and we'll see. It's here.
It's here.
And I feel like there's a level of control release even greater than like opening a restaurant, because you're putting your book out into the world, and when you're in a restaurant, you can stand and look at people's faces.
Totally.
And experience it with the book. It's out of your
hands.
It's very abstract.
I can't take it back now. I still haven't found a typo, knock on wood. And if you find one out there, please don't Instagram me and tell me about it.
I don't even want to know.
Under wraps.
Yeah. Thank the Lord.
So, Rob, this... The book I'm actually holding in my hands right now, you might hear me flipping through the pages. It's so gorgeous, and it doesn't look like every other book. It's so beautifully laid out. The photography is amazing. The colors are just gorgeous, and like the cover is this kind of beautiful, like muted gray linen. What did it feel like when you held it in your hands, and like was it what you pictured exactly when you picked up your first proof, we'll say?
That's a lot, man. I had always envisioned having the cover be some winding road, which has actually wound up not working for reasons I'll tell you in just 1 second. But the picture that I thought was going to be the cover is one of the first few pages. So it didn't feel like what I thought it was going to be in that sense. But having said all that, I love the cover. That was shot in the Delta at like 6 a.m. I worked with two different photographers, the food and main photographers, Emily Dorio or Emily Hall. And then Eve Assad is like a really badass landscape photographer. And she got that shot really early in the morning. So it's better than what I thought it was going to be. And the reasons we didn't go with the road is, and you know, I have a strong personality and strong opinions and all that jazz, but I listened to the publishers when they said that if we go down that, I guess that's a pun I'm making, go down the road of having a road, it would look like a travel book, and they were right. Oh. You know, it didn't evoke like food. Mm-hmm. And they were right, and it turned out cool. And I don't do a lot of green stuff, so that's also kind of weird, but I like it. You know, I'm Mr. like blue and gray and like, uh-huh. I don't know, but yeah, I'm really, really happy with it. It turned out really nice.
So you have precise rows instead of a winding road here, but
this
what
still
are these
kind of,
rows of?
I think it's soybeans.
It's, yeah, gorgeous.
Yeah, but I'm not really sure. I think it is. We're going to go with that.
Can you talk about like sort of the concept of the book, what people can expect when they crack it open?
For sure. The concept, overarching idea is to break the South down into five subregions, Upper South, Deep South, Gulf Coast, Low Country, and Tidewater Coastal Plains, which is kind of Virginia, North Carolina. But within that sort of discussion and within that context, I wanted to sort of lay the groundwork about who was sort of in that region after Native Americans that kind of made the region what it is culinarily. But then more important to me, more interesting to me is who's arriving now and what their contributions are to Southern food and what it may look like going forward. really what I'm into.
What are some examples of that, like kind of new exciting developments within Southern cuisine?
Oh, there's so many. The Kurdish population in Nashville. I have a recipe in the Deep South part of that book. All the Vietnamese stuff in the Gulf Coast. That's so interesting to me. The Filipino population on the coast of coast of Virginia is kind of surprising to people. Things like that, you know, and the Latino population everywhere in the South. It's you know, if you just go to any town of any size, you can almost always find a Latino market. You can almost always find an Asian grocer of some type. And I used to, when I was head restaurants in Brooklyn, I'd go down south to do events. I would often drive because I really like a road trip. And I would have to stop in some town to buy some weird ingredient that I was going to need. And I, you know, it just sort of put me on this path of thinking about all of these different groups that are living in the South. And they're Southerners, too. They live there, you know. And I just found the whole concept really interesting. And I think if you get out and look for it, it's there. And I find that cool.
Can we talk about your kind of background in early childhood growing up since, you know, is also like a very personal book. I discovered a few years ago that you're from Mountain Home, right?
Yeah. Do you know about Mountain Home?
I do, because one of my dearest friends is from Mountain Home.
Get out of here.
And she taught me a cheer, but I wish I could remember
it. Oh, God, I won't know that.
Yeah, but...
even if I did, I wouldn't do it.
Ever learned.
Is it like our mascot is the Bombers? Is it some kind of bomber cheer?
I'm going to be a terrible friend and not remember the cheer.
I'm glad you don't remember.
It's not something that it comes naturally to me.
Yeah.
The cheerleading part, but...
Totally.
Talk about Mountain Home, because I think it's a small town, right?
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's up close to Missouri. It's really beautiful there. It's really hard to get to because I'm from the middle of nowhere. Mm-hmm. And where my family's actually really, really from, going back to the 1800s, is about 30 miles outside of this small town, really small place called Oakland, which is super in the middle of nowhere. And it kind of ends where these lakes are. It's like 10,000 people. My whole family is from there forever. And it's just really beautiful. I like visiting there. I don't know if I could live there, but this is where I'm from, you know, so I enjoy going back and visiting.
What's the food scene like?
Well, there's a Thai restaurant that my mom likes a lot. I've yet to go eat there with her, but I will soon. There was a Vietnamese place, but it went out of business. I'm not sure what that means. There are a couple catfish houses, which I really enjoy. I love fried catfish. Those are pretty fun. There's some barbecue places there, but I don't really think Northern Arkansas is known for barbecue so much. I would say using the word food scene might be a stretch, but there are places to eat.
Yeah, what about like home cooking? Like what's that like in the Ozark area where you're from?
Cook is called, I mean, that area is called the Ozarks. It's really simple, really like peasant-y. That's one of the things I get into in the book, actually. It's trying to sort of break this overarching stereotype of Southern food as being a bowl of hush puppies and shrimp and grits. Like, I never, ever had shrimp and grits growing up because that's, we didn't even eat grits. We eat a lot of cornmeal in many different iterations, but grits and collard greens was not like a thing. We would pick poke salad in the spring and turnip greens sometimes, spinach and things like that. My mom like still does like greens a lot. My dad, not so much. But a lot of pork, pretty decent amount of foraging. Like, people kind of get into that there. Mm-hmm. I often tell the story of the first mushroom I ever had in my entire life was a morel that we'd picked like this spring, one spring. A lot of trout fishing going on there. A lot of bean eating, pinto beans and white beans, mostly pinto beans.
Was preserving a big part of
totally,
the culture?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. We had a garden every summer. My mom would can green beans every summer. Tons of tomatoes, and then she'd make tomato sauce. Not like Italian, just like tomatoes in a jar.
Yeah.
And you can do whatever you want to in the winter.
Yeah.
A lot of wild grapes. We would pick wild grapes in the fall. My mom would make jelly.
What kind of grapes are we talking about? Concord? Or?
They're Concord-ish, but I don't really know what their name is, but they're like Concord.
Like a thick skin.
Yeah.
Would they be like a muscadine? Or is that?
No, it's not that. I know what that is for sure. You know, you can get those here in Chinatown this time of year.
Really?
Yeah.
Let's go.
Yeah.
For real.
Yeah. I would bet you that there's some there now because this is the fall, right? Yeah.
Well, I was in Alabama a few weeks ago and we were at a farm and they had big vines of muscadines.
Were you in Alabama?
Near Auburn.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So pretty far south. But yeah, they were, I think like right now they'd be perfect. Season for it.
I think they're out there. Yeah.
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 I'm curious if you can kind of talk about breaking up the regionality of this book and like how you approached, you said five different regions of the book.
Yeah, it's going to make people mad, I'm sure.
But it's so interesting. I mean, it's like, especially you're talking about like your experience of Southern cuisine is obviously very different than someone on the Gulf Coast.
Mm-hmm.
How did you decide to draw those boundaries? And like, if you had to, I don't know, like, summarize each one with like a sentence of like what is the essence of that region's version of Southern food?
Well, I sort of came upon this notion when I was planning and running Seersucker because I was doing Southern food in Brooklyn, in New York. Mm-hmm. But I was using my experience in the South and my desire to delve deeper into Southern cuisine and Southern history and Southern food a little more. I just sort of used that approach because I had respect for these different regions. I knew that my South was different than other people's experience of Southern cuisine. So I just had these somewhat imaginary lines in my head when I would want to work on a dish or work on a concept for the restaurant. And then they just became more solidified as the book moved on. At one point, I wanted to have the Gulf Coast and the Delta be like a region, but it was just kind of hard to delineate on a map. But I feel like the Gulf Coast is so connected to the Delta, obviously with the Mississippi River. Mm-hmm. But and migration patterns in the early 20th century, and there's a lot of really interesting things going on there. But I just felt it made a little bit more sense to break it up the way that I did. So it's Upper South, which kind of cuts my home state right in half, which makes sense to me because Arkansas is kind of the tail of two states. It's very mountainous up north and it's very flat and has the Delta in the South. It was also divided that way around war and slavery too, which is a whole different show. So it kind of goes straight across, and Upper South incorporates Kentucky and West Virginia, Tennessee, and then the Deep South is the other part of Arkansas. The upper part of Louisiana, and just, then it kind of goes west across all the way down to I-10, which cuts across like Mobile and it cuts across those southern states. So there's, you know, Louisiana, Arkansas, Mississippi, Alabama, all the way over to Georgia is what I call the Deep South. And then the Gulf Coast is the bottom part of those states, you know, so Louisiana, Alabama. Controversially, I put just a little bit of Florida in there, in the panhandle, because it does feel kind of southern there.
I agree.
The rest
with that
of Florida
assessment.
Is
not the South.
Kind of not really the South, but maybe somebody should write their own book about that state, because I think there's a lot of interesting things going on there. But I just don't think of Tampa and think of southern food. And then the Gulf, Coastal Plains and Tidewater is most of Virginia, most of North Carolina, right up till and through the Piedmont until you get up around Asheville and you start getting into the mountains. Mm-hmm. And then that you get back into the Mountain South, which is also the Upper South.
So the book covers a lot of like traditional cuisines that also have a lot of kind of immigrant cuisine influences on them. And I'd love to hear your perspective on how sort of cuisines get transplanted or interpreted when chefs move around and when home cooks move around. And I'm specifically thinking of, I just also remembered from your bio that you used to be the executive chef at Simon Pierce in Queechee, Vermont.
Do you know that place too?
I do. I used to live up the street from there.
What is going on?
She's been following you.
You're stalking me. Is this some kind of intervention? What is happening right now?
But
who's going to come out of the door?
Vermont is like about as far from the South as you could get.
Man, Vermont's gorgeous.
And, so Simon Pierce, if any of our listeners are not familiar, it's this amazing artisan glass blowing factory. It's situated above a water mill in Queechee, Vermont, which is like a typical place to go for leaf peeping, and Queechee Gorge is like a local attraction. You go out and go swimming in very, very cold water. And the restaurant in Simon Pierce is particularly like awesome to eat at because you get to eat on all of the ceramics and glassware that come from the factory. So it's like an incredibly luxurious experience. But you're in Vermont, which is, you know, it's a super white state. The cuisine around you is pretty like typical New England. So how did you approach that executive chef role and like bring in your background? And then how do you see like types of cuisine patterns getting stamped or changed kind of throughout the South and throughout the book? That's a big question.
Man, that's a mouthful. I feel like you're on the Vermont Tourism Board a little bit. I want to know where you I lived in South Pomfret. Where did you live?
Oh, I lived in Hanover.
Oh, in New Hampshire. Did you go to Dartmouth or something?
I went to Middlebury, but then I worked at a tech company.
I see. Yeah. I see. All right, back to your question. man, it's beautiful up there. It's just hard to make a living in Vermont. Well, I would say that that was a long time ago, and I believe the path that most chefs take is to get as far away from whence you came. And that was a period of time when I just left New York City. And I really wasn't aware of my southernness. You know, I was aware that I was from the South, and I was aware that everybody thought I should know how to make fried chicken. But I didn't really care about that at that time. And I really wasn't exploring. I was just skimming the surface with like Edna Lewis and, you know, Frank Stitt and these people who are legends in Southern food. So I really wasn't doing too much with Southern food. I was more French and, of course, Asian, because that's always been a constant in my life. and the types of food that goes on at that restaurant, it's very chef-driven, so you can kind of do whatever you want. So I wouldn't say that I was doing a lot of Southern food there. Is that even close to answering your question?
Yeah, no. So like, I don't know, I feel like we meet a lot of chefs who start off their careers kind of doing what they think people want them to do.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, we meet a lot of people who kind of eventually start like peeling back those layers and getting down to, you know, what they may not have realized they were driven to do from the beginning, which sounds like a little cliche, but I wonder if that at all is like relatable for you as something where you sort of decided to go back to really understand Southern cuisine and what that means.
I think it was part of the process of getting toward there. I think at that point in my career, that's a really good, really intense question. You're making me think. I appreciate that. I think I was still finding myself culinarily because I was probably 30, mm-hmm. and probably wasn't ready to be an executive chef, but I had all this New York City experience, which is kind of a rare thing in Vermont.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, so that's which is where just where I found myself, and it was a great learning experience. And I think that young chefs or wherever you are in your career, I think you have to go through that process of hopefully you'll find out what your cuisine is and what your, I mean, it sounds very lofty and very narcissistic in a way, but it just takes time and life experience and understanding your history and understanding where you come from and delving into it to get to arrive at a point where you feel like you have something to say. Mm-hmm. And that took like 10 more years before I opened my first restaurant that was very, very personal to me.
Can I ask you about a specific recipe?
Never.
Please. Because it made me really hungry this morning. Mm-hmm. So the trout that we were
Yeah,
because you mentioned trout when you were talking about the Ozarks.
Totally.
In the book, you have a very, very, you know, maybe some would say surprising interpretation of trout, which is a Vietnamese recipe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's called cha ca. For all you Vietnamese people out there, I'm sure I'm butchering the way that that's pronounced. I
left that to you. You
know, yeah, I don't know. I know how to order iced coffee and beer and pho, and I don't really know. I don't know how to. Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, Café Soda. So cha ca is a really unique dish that you can get it in other places in Vietnam, but it's a Hanoi specialty, which is in the north, which is a little bit cooler and in terms of climate.
Temperature.
Yeah, right. I don't know. I just felt there are a lot of Laotians that live in and around Asheville and the mountains, and I met some really interesting people that are growing like sticky rice, and I met this guy who has like a small kiwi orchard in western North Carolina outside of Asheville. And I just felt like that was, it just feels mountainous, and I just felt like to do an interpretation of that dish made sense in that region. I also have bought trout for a very long time from Sunburst Trout, which is right outside of Asheville, so it felt right on that level. It's a family-owned trout farm situation that's been there since, I think, the 50s or 40s. And I've always loved dill, and for those that don't know what cha ca is, it's, you get to sort of make it at your table. They have like little hot plates they bring out, but the fish has kind of already been cooked, so you're really just warming it up. So they bring out this fish and they turn on the little burner and you act like you're cooking. But the big moment is when they put just an absolutely insane amount of dill in the pan and it gets wilted down with green onion tops. And I don't know, that just feels really Southern to me. And I was sitting in Vietnam and eating this, and it's obviously the fish has turmeric and all these other marinades on it, and fish sauce, and it takes it away from being Southern. But it just felt instantly really familiar to me, and obviously really, really unique by wilting just a ridiculous amount of dill.
It's
and
like it, as much dill as fish.
Mm. Yeah, yeah, and it's just, I just absolutely adore that dish, and I've done it for years, and since I've discovered I did it at Nightingale 9 here, and I'm doing it in Nashville now, and I just love it, and it's in the book, and if you don't have a grill, you can do it in your broiler, you can pan sear it, and this is all about really the marinade and the dill, and then when you get the dill wilted with the green onion tops, not the bottoms, and then the peanuts get in there, and it's like textural and herbaceous, I'm super into it.
I like how you say it, of like, like, it's not you doing it. It's not you putting the peanuts there. The peanuts just get in there.
Yeah, yeah. Right. They just magically show up, yeah. And when you're in Vietnam, you have rice noodles on the table and all these different things spread out, and you can just kind of make your own little situation. And I think it's one of Vietnam's great dishes.
So what? Hungry.
That's so delish.
Yeah, yeah. So, I don't know. That's probably one of those dishes that people will be like, what the hell? This is not Southern food. But to me, it kind of is. There's a lot of Vietnamese people that live in the South. Like Arkansas, where I'm from, like Fort Chaffee, Arkansas was like a big, I hate to use the word distribution point, but it was a point where a lot of refugees would be put together, and then they would, the government would find them homes and send them to different places. You know, that's that, the Vietnamese presence in the South has been happening since the 70s, and it's a fine line between a banh mi and a po' boy. You know what I mean?
Yes.
They're like cousins. You know?
Yeah.
So
just last thought on that note, because we have an entire show about this.
About what?
So
po' boys and banh mi's? I want to be on that show.
Thoughts on what is kind of cultural appropriation versus cultural
appreciation. I'm not touching that.
Oh. Pass.
You tread that like very beautifully, and
thank you.
You know, you have your own interpretation, and you are you're doing the opposite of claiming it, where you're using the book to sort of underscore and reinforce the importance of immigrant cuisines in the South. So I guess that's not a question, but like
thoughts.
I'll say thank you, and I won't answer that question. I don't really feel like I appropriate anything. I think appropriation ends when deep respect is there. Mm-hmm. And I spent a lot of time in Vietnam. I've traveled that country more than most, I would say. Like, I've been to weird little towns and cooked in kitchens with nice ladies. And I just have a profound respect for the food. It's a really, really unique place that the French were there for 150 years and left their mark on a lot of things, negative, but certainly on food. It's light and clean, and my experience there and my time understanding or getting to understand that food has changed my food. And that sounds like a very narcissistic, preposterous thing to say, but just the way I approach food now is super light and clean and herbaceous and full of acid, and I put fish sauce in everything because it's delicious. Yes. And you should do that. If you don't have fish sauce at home, you're not doing it right. And if you taste it in your food, you've used too much. So don't be scared of it, and it's good in everything. I don't see it as appropriation. I see it as advancing a dialogue about a cuisine. And I know, like, I'm a tall white guy who really likes to make Vietnamese food and other Asian cultures, but I just feel like I'm adding to the conversation instead of trying to take something from it.
Yeah. And I think it relates back, too, to what you said about finding yourself as a chef and as a young chef, traveling being so important.
Yeah.
To kind of getting to find that.
For sure.
Because, you know, we live in a global society now.
And, yeah. I went to Peru a couple years ago to sort of explore that idea a little bit, because the I don't know how many people know this, but the Japanese, after the end of isolationism, were moving to different places, and Peru is one of the places that they went. And Japanese culture in Peru was so, I won't say seamlessly integrated, but it's so present there that they have their own style of cuisine called Nikkei. And they had a Japanese prime minister for about a decade who wound up in jail, but that's a different show and a different story. And they also have the same thing going on with Chinese food there. They have their own style of Chinese Peruvian food called Chifa. And I just find that really, really fascinating, and the word appropriation doesn't even enter my mind when I think about something like that. And I just think it's really unique and cool and adds to the richness of Peru, which is, if you haven't been, you should go. It's a really cool place. I mean, Machu Picchu, I didn't even get to all that. I just did Lima.
Just busy with the food. Yeah.
Yeah, or ayahuasca. I didn't do that either. But
that's fine. That makes the food come back.
Peru is so cool because they have, yeah, right. You know, they have a coffee situation going on. They have avocados. They're on the ocean. They have mountains. It's kind of like California. You know, they have their own.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I've had any Peruvian. I thought it all got turned into Pisco.
There's also that.
Yeah, I've never had that. I would love to try Peruvian wine.
There's some decent wines, and then, I mean, Pisco is great fun.
You know where I had some wine? The wine in Vietnam, I didn't like so much. But wine that really surprised me was in Burma.
Hmm.
I had some really... Whoa. A step above drinkable wines from Burma. Tempranillos and Sauvignon Blancs. Really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, right? That's the noise I made when I saw these things. I was like, huh? What?
Yeah.
Yeah.
On the Burmese wine note, let's take a really quick break and we'll be right back.
Speaking of Burmese wine.
Yeah. Go buy your Burmese wine during the break.
Yeah, there's a Burmese wine commercial.
Brought to you by Wines of Burma.
Okay.
How
are
we doing on time?
Good. Yeah. A couple more questions than trivia.
Mm-hmm.
Great. Okay. We're back. with HR and Happy Hour with our guest, Rob Newton. So, Rob, let's talk a little bit more about sort of your fairly recent move from New York to Nashville. And can you talk a little bit about sort of the similarities and differences between the restaurants that you had here in Brooklyn versus Gray and Dudley in Nashville?
Yeah.
You said, you mentioned a dish that you have, you know, brought through, but what's the same? What's different?
About my experiences there versus like living here?
Yeah.
Well, East Nashville is basically Brooklyn.
Totally.
There are a lot of
miss us at all.
Really. Yeah.
So I feel like you've moved down there with me, and I like Nashville. I like being back in the South. I like being close to my family. I can drive there in a day if I need to, or want to. I work for this really cool hotel group called 21C. They're based out of Louisville. They're primarily in the South, but they're expanding beyond that as we speak. So I guess the experiences of owning my own place versus working for a hotel is, I can only speak to my experience about it, and 21C has been incredibly generous from a food perspective because they want their restaurants to be chef-driven, which is like a cliche term or whatever, but it's really true. The menu is completely mine. Some things I do on there, like the chaka that I did in Brooklyn. I don't know. I'm doing cornbread there the way that I did it at Seersucker. I can't think off the top of my head other dishes that I've done in the past. I'm not really big on that, to be honest with you, like bringing out old war horses of dishes, you know. Mm-hmm. But I did want to have some dishes on the menu that are in my book. So the Vietnamese coffee cake, or I think it's called Vietnamese coffee cake in the book. I have that on the menu right now. I have the cornbread, like I said, the trout. I have there's country ham and shrimp lumpia. That's from the Tidewater Coastal Plains chapter of the book. Very Filipino-inspired dish. I have that dish in its entirety on the menu right now. So my experiences about cooking in the South versus owning my own restaurant, which I think is the question, it's been a pretty cool transition. You know, it's kind of a unique thing to go from owning your own place to going back to working for someone. But sometimes that's what happens in life, and that's the way it's playing out. And I'm happy there. I'm happy in Nashville. I found a place where I really like to have pho, which is really important to me, mm-hmm. for whatever reason.
What place is that?
It's called Huang Tofu. It's the weirdest name. It's probably misleading to most people. But
you go and sell beef broth?
Yeah, well, they make their own tofu there, okay. And they sell soy milk. And it's a really nice family-owned place. They have a really small menu, which I find refreshing. They have like 10 things. It's really cool. So I would say the only things I really miss in Nashville is Chinese food. Mm. But most of the things that interest me, I can find there. And, you know, I just want to be back in the South when my book came out. And I also felt after almost 20 years in New York, being from the South, I felt like I'd done enough stuff in New York, and it was okay, and it was time to go back down South, and I feel good about all that.
Seems reasonable.
Yeah.
Is there a difference in the sort of chef to chef culture in Nashville versus in New York or Brooklyn specifically?
It's smaller. I would say, I don't know if it's any friendlier or not friendly. I would say it's kind of similar. I feel like you see chefs out more probably in Nashville than in New York, but that's probably just due to population density. You know? Yeah. And there are more like bars here than there are
work hours. Like,
what?
Is there a difference in like work-life balance, or is that it just is crazy to be a chef?
Anyway? No, I think you just work hard as a chef. I think that's just what people
no matter
do.
What.
Yeah.
I was talking to a chef in Georgia who was mentioning that he believes every major city in America right now wants to have like really great Southern restaurants. Mm. And I'm wondering if you find that to be true, if you see as you've traveled throughout the country that a Southern restaurant is kind of like something that people want, whether the chefs want to open it, people want to eat there. And I frankly feel like there's a lot of maybe bad cliche Southern restaurants, and maybe not restaurants in line with sort of this hyper local regional sort of cuisine popping up. What have you seen? What do you think?
I mean, you could probably make a whole show out of that, whether, you know, I think somebody did an article in the Oxford American that I was a part of about if you can make Southern food outside of the South. And I think the answer is, of course, yes. I think it depends on what your motivations are. Because you could say that there's like Southern food appropriation, you know, and I don't want to get into all that, but I don't know. What are your motivations, you know? I think Cracker Barrel is all over the place, and people think that's Southern food, you know? No disrespect, Cracker Barrel. Don't come after me.
Maybe not. It's its own thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not saying that I think Southern food is represented by Cracker Barrel at all.
Rocking chairs? Yes.
Say otherwise.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there's... I'll say this. I'll say that, and it's in my book, too. I think Southern cuisine is one of, if not the greatest, of the American cuisines or the American cuisine. It's like it's the most storied, the most controversial. So I think it only makes sense that other people in other regions of this country and beyond want to get their hands on that and try it and see what it's all about. I don't know if people were having this dialogue when, you know, French and Italian chefs were coming over in the 50s and 60s and 70s to New York to cook. No one was asking, like, can you even make French food here? They were just doing it.
Yeah.
So I think it's kind of the same.
Yeah.
You know?
I like that. I like putting Southern cuisine on the same sort of playing field as.
Look at what all these cool Japanese chefs are doing in Paris. I mean, nobody's even talking about what. They're just making badass food. It doesn't matter that they're Japanese, really. You know, it's like, who cares? They're really adding something to Parisian, in particular, dining scene.
Mm-hmm.
I've eaten at some of those places. It's really cool elements that it's just happening organically with what they're doing.
Yeah. Last thing I wanted to mention while I'm thinking about it.
No, let's keep the show going.
Let's go. I have a book recommendation that I think would be an interesting sort of like companion to your book.
Okay.
It's called Spying on the South.
What?
And it's a book where Tony Horowitz, the author, retraces Frederick Olmsted's travels through the antebellum South.
Whoa.
It's fascinating. Totally not a cookbook, obviously.
Was he building parks and stuff?
He wasn't at the time. He was an undercover writer for the New York Times.
What?
Yeah, crazy. Absolutely bananas. And it's just, and he's like obviously very sort of politically motivated.
I'm so buying that book.
It is amazing.
Do you know that he has, I was in Montreal this summer. It was an annual trip my mom and I take. We go different places. And he, I believe he designed the parks that are around Mount Royal.
That would make sense.
Have you guys been to Montreal?
That's
a whole other show. Yeah. That's a badass city, man. I really had fun there.
Me too. I went about a year ago.
Yeah.
Amazing. Great time to go.
Shout out to my mom. She's like 70, and we climbed that thing.
Dang.
She rocked it.
I didn't even do that.
Good job, Mom, if you're listening.
Go, Mom.
But yeah, it's an amazing book. It's
Spying
really
on the South.
A page-turner. And
I'm
going
to get that.
You'll love it because, I mean, he goes all the way through to Texas, and he tries to, like, take boats where he would have taken boats. And it's like he has to ride on a coal barge because steamboats don't exist on the Ohio River anymore.
Wow.
And I think it's an interesting sort of, like, look back at that time period, and then I think it.
Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. The Hearst family has been raising cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of California's Central Coast for over 150 years. Piedra Blanca Rancho in San Simeon is the original Hearst Ranch, founded by George Hearst in 1865. George's son was the famous publisher William Randolph Hearst. In addition to being known for building the iconic Hearst Castle, William was, like his father before him, an avid rancher. In his words, "I would rather spend a month at the ranch than any place in the world." Thanks to one of the largest land conservation easements in California history, a joint effort with the California Rangeland Trust, the American Land Conservancy, and the state of California, The working landscape at Hearst Ranch will be preserved forever. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
Okay, you guys ready for some trivia?
No!
We're here for you. None of us have seen
you. Have some help. Oh, so I get lifelines.
Oh, yeah. All the lifelines.
Am I the only one playing trivia?
No, it's everybody.
Oh, okay.
I'm challenging you all.
I was like, nobody in the email said there'll be trivia. Nobody ever said that.
Surprise.
Right. I'm ready.
Okay. So,
I'm caffeinated.
Because we're talking about Seeking the South, I have some trivia today about official foods of southern states.
Oh, my God. I'm not an expert on that.
We'll start easy, I think. What's Florida's state pie?
Oh.
Oh, that's not southern, really, but key lime, I'm guessing?
Yeah.
Gotta be.
That's right. Yeah, so we started with one that's maybe not actually the South. Okay.
It wasn't it's that
okay.
easy.
It's okay. What is Georgia's state vegetable?
Collards, maybe?
Oh, no. I thought you were saying something else.
Oh. Oh. Wait, so what looks like
state
collards?
Vegetable.
It's a specific type of a vegetable.
Why couldn't you just ask about peaches like everybody else?
Yes. Right? I don't know if they're legit.
Oh, yeah, it must be kind of legit. Peach, no?
And it's not a peach. It's the other thing that they're known for that's named after a part of the state.
Oh, the peanuts is a legume?
Part of the state.
I'll give you guys
man,
a hint.
I'm failing.
It's a type of onion.
Oh, Vidalia. Oh,
there you go.
Of course.
Our sweet, sweet Vidalia.
Oh, I'm failing.
What is Texas's state pepper? Think Tex-Mex.
Well, oh, a jalapeno?
Yep.
Gotta be.
Good. Strong comeback.
Yep.
Okay,
that
here's...
Solid. We try to write these so that nobody can ever get any right. So you're doing really well.
All right, here we go. Here's Arkansas.
Oh, God. Okay.
What is both Arkansas's state fruit and state vegetable? It's in both categories.
Oh, my God. Is that a tomato?
It is a tomato. Do you know what kind of tomato?
My dad was always into Jetstars, but I don't think that's what you're looking for. Oh, Cherokee?
No.
Cherokee Purple?
Not a Cherokee Purple.
Brandywine?
Nope.
Can I have a lifeline? These guys don't know.
It's very specific.
It is an heirloom variety?
I think so. It's the South Arkansas Vine Ripe Pink Tomato.
Oh, my God.
I would never have gotten
it. Have you had that? Have you heard of it?
I don't even know anything about that.
That's wild.
Meaning it's pink when it's ripe.
So, like, some farmer, like, that grew these, like, got... lobby government to yeah, be like make like this there the
there's only one person I can think of who might know. It's Matt McClure, who's the chef of 21C in Bentonville. If he doesn't know that tomato, nobody's gonna know that tomato.
We'll have to ask him. All right,
we're gonna call him up and be like, random trivia question.
Yeah. Okay, we have almost mentioned this answer. I'm just gonna put that out there as a hint. What is North Carolina's state fruit?
Well, it's not the kiwi because people don't even know they grow kiwis.
Mm-mm.
Well, I know they're the sweet potato state.
No.
Yeah. They're the largest sweet potato producer.
That's interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah, I learned that doing this book.
Okay.
Fruit.
I'll tell you what it was that we mentioned that's close.
Not a peach.
It was the muscadine. It's
close. Oh, that makes sense.
It's close to the muscadine.
That makes sense.
Do you know what it is?
Oh, it's close to the muscadine. a grape of some type?
It is a grape.
Some kind of
grape. Oh, not a Concord.
Mm-mm.
But
it has a funny name.
Oh.
Its name traces back to the Algonquin word for sweet bay tree.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I don't know.
It is the scuppernog.
Oh, man, I should have known that.
I thought you would.
I'm gonna tip my tongue.
Love scuppernog.
Man,
that's the other thing
that.
I ate at
massive
the farm
fail.
In Alabama.
I find at least
massive
six
fail.
To say scuppernog today.
Scuppernog. I love a scuppernog.
I knew that.
All right. You've mentioned this also, so just think back a little bit. What's South Carolina's state snack?
Cracklins?
No. Should be, though.
Pimento cheese?
Mm-mm.
I don't know.
Hint, the Lee brothers.
Boiled peanuts?
Correct.
Oh, right on.
Yep.
Right on. Yeah.
And this is the hardest one, but I had to throw it
oh,
in.
Oh, really? I feel like we've done that already.
This is the hardest
one. It's
like
one. A 60 minutes interview.
What is Alabama's state dessert?
Oh.
Pie or cake?
Is it a hummingbird cake?
No, you're close. You're very close.
Really? Coconut cake?
You're close-ish. Hint is that it was given as a welcome gift in To Kill a Mockingbird. And it was invented in my home county. Claim to fame.
It's one of these cakes with tons of stuff on it, right?
It's not as crazy as the hummingbird cake. It's a little more simple. But it's still like...
Somewhere in between coconut and hummingbird.
Yeah.
Sounds massive scary. Fail.
It's called the Lane cake.
Oh, wow. Explain. What's in it?
I don't remember. Julia Bainbridge did a really lovely write-up about the history of it in Bake from Scratch.
Cool.
Nice. Yeah.
Very cool.
Our favorite baking magazine.
Yes. Okay, well, that's all our Southern food trivia. You won.
No, I didn't. I failed. Massive fail. No.
You did great. Those were hard.
Everybody out there is like, sure, he wrote a book. Right, yeah. Doesn't even know what Scuppernog is.
You can see it. It's beautiful.
Are there Scuppernogs in this book?
No. One last thing I'll say about that is I didn't do things like that because and Jamie Feldmar, who's an awesome writer and helped me write this book, and shout out to her. She helped keep the trains on time. But I was sort of always writing for this like fictitious character in my head, and it was a woman for whatever reason, and I wanted that person to always be able to find these ingredients pretty easily. Mm-hmm. And muscadine and scuppernogs are not what she would be able to find, so I kind of just veered away from things like that. I have lots of respect for those ingredients, even though I apparently don't know what scuppernog is.
I think you like have to have a farm in the South to be able to like readily access muscadines and scuppernogs.
Yeah. And to readily access that like little brain cache where where scuppernog lives.
Yes.
Or go pick wild grapes like my mom and make jelly.
There you go.
Like yeah.
There you go.
Which not everybody can do.
Last question for you. At one point, were you considering doing like a more Vietnamese cookbook, like centered on that cuisine? Or is it always going to be like this, Seeking the South?
No, I was never going to do that. I think that's a fun idea, though.
I don't know where I came up with that idea, but yeah. Just putting it out there, maybe. Seems like there's a whole lot of recipes that we all want to eat.
Yeah, I'm working on this whole other idea that I think will be really cool. And I got really lucky with my my agent, David Black. Shout out to David Black. He liked this idea from like the first moment and just jumped on it and ran with it. And I got spoiled because I've been presenting him ideas over the last 3 months and he hates every single one of them. He literally he just like raises his eyebrows and is like, no, we're not doing that. Why would you do that? And I just think, I have this one idea that I think is so badass that I'm not gonna share because I still think it's a badass idea. But he finally has gotten behind this other thing, which kind of, I'm saying all that because it's kind of like what you're describing, but more. I think it would be a place where all those cool Asian things I have in my head mm-hmm. could find a home.
Mm-hmm. Quick, turn off the mic so we can ask Rob about it.
Yeah. All right, we gotta go. Right. We need the scoop.
Well, I just have one thing I would like to say, which is, first of all, enormous thank you, Rob, for coming on our show, making us the first stop on your book tour.
Oh, my God. Thank you for having me. It's so great to be back here and see you all.
And just on behalf of HRN, I want to say thank you for something really, really huge that you helped us do a couple of years ago, which was to pull off our first gala.
Oh, yeah.
At the Palm House and Yellow Magnolia Cafe at the Brooklyn Botanic Garden. We're coming up to year number 3 and
I love it.
Of the gala, and we're also celebrating our 10th anniversary. And we seriously wouldn't have been able to do it without you. Thank you for helping us get that momentum.
That gives me goosebumps.
We did it in 6 weeks when we first had the idea.
Crazy.
I remember pulling over on the side of the road and having a conference call. And I was driving somewhere. It was wild.
I mean, you thank you. Because from the bottom of our hearts, that's been an awesome fundraiser for us. It's such a fun event and really couldn't have done it without you. And also because in honor of your book launch today and for all of your contributions to HRN, I'm very pleased to let you know that you're also one of our newest inductees into the Hall of Fame.
Ooh,
which is part of our 10th anniversary celebration.
Jeez Louise.
We just so appreciate you and
everything
you've done to support the network and all you're doing for Southern food and food in general and making the world more equitable, sustainable, and delicious, which is what we're all here to do. So,
what a giant hug. Thank you. That's amazing for you to say all those wonderful things. It's been my pleasure. I love what you guys do, and I want to support it any way I can. And Patino is a really cool partner and all that, and it's just a win-win for everybody. So I don't really feel like I did much, but thank you for saying all those nice things.
We do.
Thank you. Thank
and
you.
We'll see you at the gala.
I will be there.
Fabulous.
Do I have to wear a tuxedo?
Yeah.
No. It depends on who you ask.
You have to wear your Hall of Fame pin, though.
Yes, we're sending you a pin.
Have you? Oh, okay. I was like, I don't have that.
Don't worry, we'll get you one.
You won't be
sure. That's uh-huh. awesome. Thank you for saying all those nice things. That was really nice.
Thank you.
Come back anytime.
I think we have to plan a trip to Nashville sometime.
Yes, please.
Yeah, please. It's really pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Love Nashville.
Please just don't come down there and wear boots and cutoffs. Just don't do that. Please
but I want to go to.
Please don't do that.
Music, whatever, row. Come on.
Broadway?
Yeah, whatever it's called.
Let's go to Hong Kong.
Just kidding. I just want to go to Grand Ole Opry.
Heard that.
Yeah.
Heard that. You don't have to wear cutoffs.
But I won't wear cutoffs. I promise.
Okay, cool. Come on down then.
I'll go to East Nashville and just dress like a Brooklyn hipster.
You'll fit right in.
Yep.
Literally.
Yep.
You won't even know you left.
Yep.
It's true. Okay, Rob, thanks so much for being here.
It has been my pleasure. Thank you.
Congratulations on the book. It's beautiful.
It's out. This is my first thing.
Yay!
We did it.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. We will be back with more Happy Hour in a week or 2 weeks or sometime. We don't know.
Some amount of time. We'll see you soon.
See you then. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you. It's so nice of you guys to say all those nice things.
Oh, my
gosh. Seriously, we wouldn't be doing this party if you weren't.
This program is powered by Simplecast.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awele, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.